For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Bradley Fuller. Over 400 years on, the works of William Shakespeare still enjoy a place of prominence in our culture. With no shortage of faithful stagings, modern adaptations, scholarly attention, and a fair share of student anxiety given in response to them. But beyond the written and spoken words of the Bard's plays, there's a sometimes forgotten musical element that can add understanding and enjoyment to these dramatic works. I'm here now with Dr. Sarah Williams, Associate Professor of Music History at the University of South Carolina School of Music in Columbia. An historical musicologist, she specializes in the popular music and culture of England from the time of Shakespeare through the beginning of the 18th century, from broadside balladry to theatrical music and street performance to popular song. Her work redefines how song, as well as descriptions of sound and music, shaped early modern English attitudes about gender, magic and the supernatural, memory, politics, and theatrical space. Sarah, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Bradley.
These days, we're fairly removed from the environment in which Shakespeare wrote his plays and then had them performed. Our first exposure might take place in a classroom, poring over small print and begging for a little help from a classmate who understands iambic pentameter better than we do. But this isn't exactly how the public in Shakespeare's day would have first encountered his plays.
That's true, and I appreciated your introduction and that students get a lot of anxiety about Shakespeare, and they encounter him first in a classroom, and I think Shakespeare probably would have been a little appalled at that notion, because just the idea that his plays would have been written down, and they were published posthumously. The first folio was published after his death. So plays were meant to be acted, not read. So I think that's the best way to experience a Shakespeare play. And the plays in Shakespeare's time were, there were two types of theaters you could go to. There were the large amphitheaters, which were typically on the outskirts of London at that time, which now is the center of London, but at the time it would have been the suburbs. And then there were smaller hall theaters where you could see different types of plays. And obviously, these spaces differed quite dramatically, and the kind of music that would have been performed there did too.
So music was an important part of theater going in Shakespeare's day.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, it could communicate all sorts of things. It could communicate a particular character's state of mind. The first thing that comes to mind for me is Ophelia in Hamlet. Her mad scene features her singing snatches of bawdy ballads, and this is a really inappropriate thing for her to do in front of Hamlet and the Queen. And those would have resonated with the audience at the time because they would have understood that this was really not a woman in her right mind.
So this would be more than some pleasant kind of background or elevator music that the audience would have forgotten when they went home. This would have been music that really spoke to them and they understood.
Right. And a lot of the music in Shakespeare's theater was staged or as a call to action. And we see the traces of this in the play text itself through stage directions or even in the dialogue. Like, let's have a song, or let's hear that strain again in the famous opening lines of Duke Orsino, that if music be the food of love, play on. He's actually speaking to musicians in front of him that would have been playing at the theater at the time. So this gives us clues as to how important music was. And we'll see, too, snatches of references to popular songs that would have been familiar to audiences in the 17th century, but are now something that we kind of have to dig up. Scholars have to dig up today.
And I think that's something that maybe some people have a hard time understanding, this idea of old popular music. The way we talk about classical music, it just seems, well, if it's before 1900 or 1950 or whenever you want to set, you know, that magical date, that it's automatically classical. But at this time, there was obviously sacred music, whether Catholicism or Protestantism was the order of the day in England. There was maybe some rarefied instrumental music for the well-to-do, but you're saying there was kind of a broader class of popular songs that everyone or just the lowers? I mean, who was enjoying this?
Of course, yeah. And there's examples of this in the theater, too. One of the best examples I can think of is a tune called Fortune My Foe. It was a popular song referenced in the theaters. It was attached as a tune indication to broadside ballads, so these kind of single-sheet publications that had poetic verse that recounted news of the day or history and myth, and they would just have the title and say, to be sung to the tune of, and then would name a popular tune. So there's no musical notation. You're just supposed to know that tune name and then sing the following verses to that tune. And the idea is that anyone could do that. You could paste those up on the walls of a tavern and people could gather around and sing the refrain along with everyone else. But Fortune My Foe is an interesting case because it went by many names. It had this nickname in the theater of the Hanging Tune, because so many broadside ballads were written to be sung to the tune of Fortune My Foe that described gallows scenes or kind of the last words of a convicted criminal. So there's a play called The Noble Soldier where the character of the poet is very nervous about writing a libel against the king. And he says, oh, to write against the king, you know, I shall have scurvy ballads made of me set to the hanging tune. So oh, well. That's a reference that people would have gotten immediately at the time. But it comes down to us. We know the musical notation because these learned, courtly composers like John Dowland, the famous Elizabethan lutenist, set the tune to lute variations. So we have notated music that has the tune running through, and so it'll be stated very simply at the beginning and then go through all of these metamorphoses and variations. And William Byrd did the same thing. And these are composers working for Queen Elizabeth, I mean, in the highest echelons of society. And they knew that music, too.
So it's essentially a courtly cover of this pop song in the streets.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so then you have to wonder what that must have felt like for the courtly musicians or even the sort of noble amateurs, what that must have felt like for them to play it at home. Did they feel like they were slumming, or was it something fun, you know, a way to kind of recapture the feeling of going to the theater in your own home?
And maybe a guilty pleasure for some of them. You mentioned in our conversation earlier about an episode between Henry Purcell and Queen Mary,
right,
was at the time.
Yeah.
Where she wasn't exactly enjoying the highbrow music too much. I mean, this is after the time of Shakespeare, but I think this
yeah.
is illustrative of the whole.
Right, and it's as you say, it illustrates how music in Shakespeare's time and later in the 17th century, too, had this ability to kind of travel amongst different groups of people in different venues. And the tune that you're referring to was called Cold and Raw, and it started out life as a tune called Stingo. And this happened often with tune names. Fortune My Foe went by several other names. And Cold and Raw started as Stingo, and then the famous wit Thomas Durfee wrote a very popular set of lyrics, and the first line was Cold and Raw the North did blow. So that became so popular that the tune eventually took on that name as a way of attaching it to this popularity. And yeah, Henry Purcell, the court composer, was invited to play for Queen Mary. This is of William and Mary, later in the 17th century. And he brought along the singer John Gosling and the famous lutenist and singer Arabella Hunt to play for Queen Mary. And Queen Mary, I guess, got tired of Purcell's music and requested Arabella to sing Cold and Raw. And Purcell was known to be kind of very irritable person, and who knows how he felt about this, but he did write in his next birthday ode for Queen Mary one section of the piece, and this is from Love's Goddess Sure Was Blind. The section, May Her Blessed Example Chase, has a bass line that is cold and raw. So maybe that's him kind of needling his patron a little bit, or maybe that's him sort of as a nod to her interests.
If you can't beat him, join him.
Exactly.
Well, going back to the time of Shakespeare, were there any composers who wrote specifically for the plays when Shakespeare was still living? So they wrote a piece not just that was used elsewhere that was then brought into the theater, but one that was from the beginning meant for this Shakespeare play.
Yeah, it's tricky. A lot of the music for Shakespeare's theater is a bit of a hodgepodge. So, you know, I mentioned there were two types of theaters. There were the large amphitheaters that we think of this when we think of Shakespeare's Globe, and there's a reconstruction of this in London on the south bank of the Thames. And then there were these smaller hall theaters that employed boy companies, boy singers and actors, and they could be much more experimental with the music that they performed, and they had set ensembles, and they were indoors, so they didn't have to be quite as loud, and they could be more subtle, because these outdoor amphitheaters, as you know, there was no amplification. So subtleties in acting and music didn't exist there. But there were a few composers that did contribute pieces for Shakespeare's, specifically for, well, we think, for Shakespeare's productions. One of them is Robert Johnson, who wrote some of the most famous music from Shakespeare's Tempest, Full Fathom Five. And during the revivals of Shakespeare's works in the Restoration, this is after the English Civil Wars in the mid-century, there were new settings of Full Fathom Five by John Bannister and Matthew Locke that really reflect the kind of change in musical aesthetic from the beginning of the century to the end of the century. Another one is Thomas Morley's It Was a Lover and His Lass, and this is from Morley's first book of airs. And this is, airs would have been, they were modeled on the French courtly air, and it was a single voice with lute accompaniment. So this would have been very genteel music. And it's one of the few formal songs from Shakespeare's plays that survives in notation. And nobody's really sure if it came first and then was used in Shakespeare's play, or if the song was composed as a commission. But it's just another really great example of this overlap between the theaters and courtly composers. Thomas Morley was, again, one of Queen Elizabeth's and then King James's court composers, and worked with William Byrd and was a printer-publisher, or held a printing privilege. So he was, you know, one of the foremost composers of the day, and madrigalists as well.
So would these court composers have been in a slightly different echelon than a lot of the theater producers and operators? I mean, how would Shakespeare himself kind of fit into this?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's not a lot known about Shakespeare's biography. We don't know exactly when he was born, so we celebrate April 23rd as his baptismal day and as his birthday. But we know he was a little bohemian. There's a portrait of him of doubtful origin that has him with a gold earring.
I've seen that one.
Yeah, which would have been kind of a mark of someone who lived a kind of bohemian lifestyle. We know, and he's also pictured in dark clothing, which we know at the time, darker clothing required a lot of dye, so that meant you were a little wealthier. We also know in one of the first descriptions of him by another playwright at the time, when we first see evidence of him on the theatrical scene in London, he was referred to as an upstart crow. That's one of his nicknames, an upstart crow. So I think people were a little skeptical of him at first. He didn't have this kind of university education that some of his contemporaries did, like Christopher Marlowe. And I think they probably saw him as a little bit of an interloper, you know, kind of bursting onto the scene.
But then he would end up interacting with William Byrd or Thomas Morley.
Right, right. And presenting entertainments for monarchs and everyone in between. So the amphitheaters, you could get in for a penny and stand in the yard, but you could pay what is the equivalent today of maybe about $40 or so to be in the Lord's box, which was very, very expensive and a very sort of conspicuous place. Not only, well, you couldn't actually see the play because you were above the stage, but you could be seen by everyone else in the theater. So there was a wide range of admission prices and clientele in a lot of Shakespeare's productions.
Are there any other common misconceptions about the time of Shakespeare and especially the music culture of that era you think it would help us to set right?
I think that it's always interesting to think about how actors engaged with music in Shakespeare's theaters. So in the big amphitheaters, they didn't employ a regular ensemble. So the actors on stage had to be trained in music as well. And they were. There's a list of the kinds of things that an actor had to be well-versed in, and they had to be good in singing and playing instruments and acting and sword fighting and wit and humor and all and elocution, and you know, the list goes on and on. But they would have been the ones playing the music. And there are, you know, a few companies that kind of work in that model today, and that's always fun to see. And of course, at the smaller hall theaters, they had professional musicians that would perform in these more musically sophisticated productions. But yeah, music is the way, I think, to get into Shakespeare's plays. If you're nervous about them, or you think they're somehow elite culture, they couldn't have been farther from the truth during his time. And I think Shakespeare would have taken offense of it being sort of a cultural snob or anything like that. But yeah, if you're afraid of getting into Shakespeare, start with the music.
And finally, what's your favorite piece of music connected to Shakespeare, whether a song from his time or a piece inspired by or written for his plays, if you had to pick a favorite?
Oh my gosh, that's so hard. I've always loved the melody, the Robert Johnson melody for Full Fathom Five. There's something about it, it's haunting, and I think that's the point. It's sung by Ariel to kind of draw the character of Ferdinand toward Prospero, who is the magician king of the island, and his daughter Miranda. And it does, it draws you in as you listen, and it has a magical pull about it. And the refrain at the end, ding dong bell, has always just kind of resonated in my mind for some reason.
Music oft hath such a charm to make bad good and good provoke to harm. Sarah, thanks so much for sharing your insights today and wishing you only good with your continued research.
Thank you so much.
That was Dr. Sarah Williams, member of the Shakespeare Association of America, associate professor of music history at the University of South Carolina, and a musicologist who researches, among other things, the music culture of Tudor and Stuart period England. Currently, she's working on digital platforms, including websites and eventually apps, that can represent historical networks of sound, space, music, and performance in 17th century lute airs, as well as 18th and 19th century Columbia, South Carolina, and its surrounding counties. For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Bradley Fuller.